Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. The U.S. birth rate is at a 40-year low, the culmination of 2 decades of Americans having fewer and fewer children. It's a crisis, according to some economists, or perhaps it's a signal that Democrats hate families. That's according to Republicans like Ohio Senator J.D. Vance. Maybe it's a recognition that the rising cost of everything, from childcare to college tuition, makes the dream of a family financially out of reach. No matter the reason why, more and more couples are choosing to be childless. And we're spending the next hour talking about what it means to be a family, why we do or don't have children, and how our politics got so tangled up with our parenting. We begin with Anastasia Berg, the co-author of the book, What Are Children For? On Ambivalence and Choice. She's also a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to All Sides, Anastasia.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with the question that gives the title of your book. What are children actually for?
Well, the title of the book is meant a little bit to be tongue-in-cheek. But also to signal at the way in which I think a lot of people are approaching the question of having children, and for the first time in history, namely by looking for kind of a list of advantages that they would give you, disadvantages of having them, trying to find a very concrete thing that having a child will serve. This, as opposed to the way that children featured in a human life until not so long ago, when it was understood as just an essential part of what it means to be a human being. People understood human life to be intergenerational. You had a past, you have a future, and often enough, you take a direct part in bringing that about. That increasingly is no longer the case.
Do you think birth control plays a role in that? Because I feel as though for so much of human history, we didn't have, I mean, I guess you could choose to abstain, but for the most part, we didn't have pretty solid ways of avoiding pregnancy.
Well, interestingly, the most recent research, be it in anthropology or historical research, suggests that throughout history, women always had different ways, albeit not as easy and reliable as they are today, but they had their ways of let's say, executing their family planning. So they had understanding of their cycles and they had access to all sorts of potions and medical remedies. So it's not true that they never had any control of it, but certainly today, not only do we have direct control of fertility through birth control and access to abortion where that is not in danger, but we also have the consciousness that comes with it, a kind of responsibility to make a very conscious choice about it.
Let's talk about some of the reasons why Americans in particular aren't having children. So Pew recently did a study of 3,000 Americans, both older Americans and younger Americans, and they asked, you know, why are you not going to have kids? Why did you not have kids? And it was interesting to see the breakdown between younger Americans and older Americans. So, for example, younger Americans, 44% of them said they wanted to focus on other things. 38% were concerned about the state of the world, the cost of raising a child, concerns about the environment. These were all much higher amongst younger Americans.
Right. And to put this in context, what was very high among older Americans was not a concrete reason as much as the explanation, you know, things didn't work out that way. So that's very interesting. It's not that they had another consideration. They said, you know, looking back at my life, I think ultimately it just didn't work out that way. So how to understand this data is a complicated question. The first thing to notice is that when asked to provide an answer from a list of alternatives on such a personal and fraught issue, a lot comes into play. So in our book, we look at a study of environmentalists who were leaning against having children or leaning for having children. And you would see that both groups will name climate change and their environmentalist cause as the reason why they're leaning or deciding the way they do. So those who are leaning against would say, I'm not having kids because of climate change. And those who are leaning for would say, I'm having kids because I want to make sure I raise the next generation of activists. And the author of this study called this the political weaponization of fertility. And in fact, I think we see it across other topics as well. So in the context of discussions of the welfare state, or rather its absence in the US, you'll see people say, I'm not going to have kids because it is too expensive, or I feel too financially precarious. In the context of threats to reproductive rights and for women, you'll have people say that they're not going to have, or they're leaning against having children because of those reasons. So it's actually quite hard to understand what is going on. We have therefore not only surveyed people for our own studies, but also tried to actually get qualitative responses and in-depth interviews to try and get a better sense of the generational differences. And what I would say, and this is kind of going back to what I just said before, is that for older Americans, the idea that they're likely to have children, that will be just a part of their life, and they'll work whatever else is going on in their lives around it, was quite natural. It's something they took for granted. You can compare it to the way that some people think about college. It might cost a lot. I might have to take debt. It might not. I'm going to go to college. So this is how people thought about having children. Today, it's much more, not that it's a choice. It's a one project among many, one possible thing I might do. And now I'm going to start having to see how it might serve me, what kind of costs it might incur. And in once you turn into that kind of question, it's really not surprising that more and more people are choosing against it.
Yeah, and we can talk about how religion factors into that in a moment. But, you know, one of the differences that I really see between generations of women in particular is I am an older millennial, but I was raised on the idea that I could have it all. I could have a career and a family. But there really wasn't much conversation about how that was going to work, about who was going to do what chores, what kind of partner would make that possible, how much mental, physical time I would be devoting to this. And I think women under 30 in particular have seen all the challenges that come with, quote, having it all, and are perhaps deciding that they just might want one or the other.
I think that's very, very true. I think there was an uncritical embrace of the idea of having it all, and specifically for women. So while we were saying women can have it all, no one was saying men can have it all,
They've had
which,
it all
as you
for
said,
out history,
well, in a way, but
in a
it also
sense,
means,
yeah.
oh, we're not expecting them to even try to really have it all. So to really be a present, responsible parent. If the question of who can have how much has to be posed to both genders at the same time, or we are not going to be able to free women to make the kind of informed choices that will make, help enable them to live fulfilling lives, whether or not that means remaining childless or having children.
Yeah, I also think the idea of family planning plays a real role here because when we've been talking about how we went from you're just going to have children to deciding when to have children. But deciding when to have children puts this pressure on us to choose the exact right moment. Because as much as we talk about having kids, there is a lot of stigma against, quote, having them at the wrong time.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. So people today throw around the sentence, people are having kids later. But that's really a small part of the story, because what's happening is that actually they're starting to think about kids much later. And this is a big difference. It is usually not the case that if you ask a woman in her mid-20s about children, she'll have actually like a concrete time in which she wants to have them. The answer more often is, well, certainly not now. So we have a self-evidence of a logic of postponement across every aspect of an adult life. I'm meant to accomplish and achieve fulfillment and readiness before I'm even free to ask myself the question of children. So I'm supposed to have personal, intersubjective, psychological stability and fulfillment. I'm supposed to be established in my career, have enough savings, have enough success, have enough money, and I'm supposed to achieve some kind of standard of readiness in my romantic relationship. These standards that I've just named are often so murky and so high that a person might never know if they've actually reached them. And so as we chase that standard, and as we postpone the beginning of thinking about children, which also means, importantly, beginning to date with a view to maybe starting a family, oftentimes we'll see that this postponement is really standing as the reason for people having either fewer children than they would say they would have liked to, or having none at all. So the decision ends up being made for them by time and inertia.
We also want to invite you to join the conversation this hour. Did you choose to have children? Did you choose not to have children? Did you delay having kids for career? Give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides at wosu.org. You know, the U.S. isn't the only country experiencing lower birth rates. Our birth rate is now about 1.6, 1.7 children per family, which is what we call below the replacement rate, which means ultimately our population could shrink rather than staying static. And this is something that, you know, Japan, Korea, countries all across this planet, particularly what we might call developed first world nations. And I think just logically that sort of surprises me because children can be expensive, but birth rates decline as countries get richer.
Yeah, so that is a kind of fact that we have to take very seriously, especially when we come to examine one very prevalent narrative about why people are not having children, which is in the US, the people cannot afford them or they don't feel financially ready for them. Those concerns are very serious, but we need to understand what lies behind them, because straightforwardly, we must notice that not only the countries that you mentioned, but also in the Nordic countries, when consorted efforts have been made to alleviate any kind of financial pressure and burden that can come with having children. So they have universal health care, they have very generous parental leave, and they have free education from age zero. Their birth rates are unaffected. Now, I should say parenthetically, I think these are very important policies that enable people to have children with ease and with dignity and in comfort. They're important for that reason. But as strategies for increasing the birth rate, we have every reason to think they're not going to work. Now, and that's also very important, as you say, to notice that in that case, not only internationally, but also nationally, the birth rate decreases as we are looking at more comfortable and affluent individuals. One of the things that explains this, I think, is because of the way in which for them, again, the salience of the very high standards of sufficient readiness plays a major role. So in the US especially, there's a kind of a caricature of millennials as immature and frivolous and they're eternal children. But this analysis actually gives us a different perspective on them, because in a way it's almost like they're too serious to refuse to take a risk. They're the opposite of frivolous and immature. They're holding themselves to these almost impossible standards of readiness before they're even willing to ask themselves this question of whether or not to have a child.
I also think the way we raise kids has changed, and that has played a role in not only choosing whether or not to have children, but I think particularly in choosing how many children that we have. And so for example, in my own life, I was at the pool the other day with a bunch of moms, and we had all our kids at the pool, and we were talking about how hard it's been to get everybody together this summer because of all the sports classes, dance classes, camps, activities, all the things that our children, quote, like needed to do while they were off from school. And it really struck me because about a year ago, there was this fascinating study into the changing rhythms of American family life. And what it found, it was that working moms today actually spend more hours on childcare than stay-at-home moms did 40 years ago. And that just crazy. Floored me. And I think if we're investing so much more time, so much more energy into the children that we have, having more than one or two just feels impossible.
I think that's really true. And I think that not only do we expect incredible investments of time. All the things that you mentioned are not just time consuming, they're resource consuming. So when we talk about how expensive kids are, a lot of time, what we're really going on is that what is expensive is to raise them at the standard of quote unquote child raising that we think is necessary. And that makes it very hard to have more children, right? The cost of every single one and every term, emotional as well, seems overbearing, but it also for those looking at it from the outside, that looks incredibly hard, incredibly unattractive. And I think perhaps the most unattractive part of it, I think, is the emotional sort of unending anxiety and fretting and always feeling like you're not doing enough because someone else is sending their kid to yet another extracurricular. And so I think those all these things are very true in how in making the question of whether or not I'm going to have children incredibly fraught.
Yeah, I mean, I have friends whose children are into travel sports, and it is a terrifying prospect to me because their whole weekends are taken up traveling to different sports games in different cities and doing different things for their children. And if you're spending all of your weekends traveling for your children's activities, yeah, the idea of having a third or a fourth kid feels impossible with your schedule.
I think that feels very hard. There was a very interesting piece in The Cut a few weeks ago, actually, and it talked about how part of the investment and attraction of team sports and just how seriously people end up taking them. Although, for most of these kids, we already know they're not going to be professional athletes. So, why can't it be kind of 80% of what you're describing? And one of the reasons is actually that among kind of in secular, liberal, progressive circles, there is a kind of vacuum or lacuna that's been created by the evacuation of a certain kind of way of thinking about values and about what family is as a seat of the transmission of value. Now, the point isn't that we should, that the solution is simply to adopt conservative values, but it's to notice that it with the with increased secularization and with sort of increased call it kind of value openness and the questions that it leaves us with, people are filling them up with content. And a lot of that content is the team of the sport, right? So it gives you camaraderie, it gives you the opportunity to socialize in a world where it's harder and harder to socialize. We have more and more loneliness. And it gives you something you're allowed to cheer for at a time where we're not allowed to cheer for a lot of teams anymore. And perhaps that is, perhaps that's how it should be, but we're not, and we want to. And so that local kitty team becomes the thing we're allowed to come together around. But as you say, taking a very high cost from us.
I want to take a call from Andrew in Grove City, who says him and his wife have decided not to have kids. Welcome to All Sides, Andrew.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, my comment was we're both young professionals, and we just determined that it wasn't financially feasible to have kids on our own. And we weren't, my wife didn't really agree with the contraception available for females, so we decided to get a vasectomy, or I decided to get a vasectomy. And then if we were to go through the route of having a familial family, so to speak, we would go the adoption route or the fostering route. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, I think that is a conversation that a lot of people have too, about particularly in the post-Dobbs world, about, when you're deciding when to have kids, you also may be saying, well, what do I do if it comes up unexpectedly?
Right. So I think that post-Dobbs, first of all, there are material threats that we can name. And mainly it's what happens, say, A, if I have an unexpected pregnancy, but for people who for whom it's deciding the way they're thinking about whether or not to have kids, one of the real fears is what happens if the pregnancy is one that I would like to terminate for a medical condition, but not one where I think that right will be guaranteed. But I think something else is happening that is no less interesting and perhaps even more influential in terms of the way it's affecting people's choices, which is that the question of children is becoming more and more politicized. I would go as far as to say it's becoming a victim of the culture wars. So there are a lot of topics where your political affiliation more or less dictates for a lot of people where they should fall on it. And kids are becoming the kind of thing that's starting to be hard to defend and justify, increasingly so in liberal and progressive circles. And so attacks on reproductive rights, I think objectively, there is still room to separate that from the individual question for a woman of what is the shape that she wants her life to take, or for a couple, for whatever kind of couple there is. Does family life part of the life that they want? But the fact that there is a conservative attack on women's reproductive rights, and the fact that that's perceived as part of a larger campaign to entrench traditional family values, alienates people from the question of children. Now, I want to say something a little controversial, which is there's a sad irony here, because when that happens, liberals and progressives, I think, and I count myself among them, we let the right control our reproductive agenda in yet another way. Not only are there making access to contraceptives and abortion hard or impossible, they're also now alienating us from one of the possibly most important projects a human being can take.
That was Anastasia Burke, co-author of What Are Children For? On Ambivalence is Choice. Coming up, we're diving into the politics of policing our families. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Stever. When we talk about families, we inevitably end up talking about politics because in America, the kind of family you choose can signal the political party that you vote for. Still with us is Anastasia Burke, the co-author of the book What Are Children For? On Ambivalence and Choice. And you know, whether a woman can support her family whether a woman can support families while choosing not to have children of her own has become a major issue in this election. And it started with this comment from vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance in 2021.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made. And so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too. And it's just a basic fact. You look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children.
Now, Vance has since said that the comment is taken out of context and that he meant to communicate his concern that Democrats don't support families. But this has sparked a national debate about what it means to be, quote, pro-family. And I think what Vance is talking about here, he's talking about being pro-having children.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do want to point out something that I think is really interesting. So at the same time as this comment has been
everywhere
a lot
lately.
Of attention everywhere lately, there is another story that's not making quite as many headlines, but in some circles is getting a lot of attention, which is a profile of Ballerina Farm.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you see, I found my audience for this comment. And so Ballerina Farm, for the listeners who are not familiar with this, is an Instagram account of a woman who's in Utah, is a Mormon family. The reason it's called Ballerina is because she, at a point in her life, was studying in Juilliard to be a ballerina. She quit, married her husband, and now has, I believe, 8 children. And there's a profile of her and her choice that came out, I think, in the Times.
The New York Times, yeah.
Is it the New York Times? Okay.
Yes.
And what was very interesting is that while we had the statement of how conservatives are really invested in the idea that childless liberal women are incredibly unhappy, in a lot of the responses to the profile, we saw a lot of investment in the idea that this conservative religious woman who chose to have as many children as she can, so it seems, is incredibly unhappy herself. So there is a lot of analysis of the profile to point out to the ways in which, you know, between the lines, there are cracks in her facade of happiness and contentment. And what I think this mutual investment in the unhappiness of people who make choices other than ours is pointing to is that A, the question, precisely the way you're putting it, is what is the role of having children in our lives and in our lives as political agents? What does it mean to be pro-family? What does it mean to be pro-women? Is pro-women a matter of being sort of dismissive and skeptical about family? Is there a way to both affirm the fully, full-heartedly, the desire to have children while also affirming the choice to remain childless? Or does it mean to, as we see with Ballerina Farm, encouraging women to have as many children as they can? And by Ballerina Farm, it's really important. She doesn't care how many children other people have, but the discourse around her seems to point in that direction.
Yeah, her name is Hannah Neilman, and I have been obsessively following the reaction to this as well, because the way the New York Times article was written, rightly or wrongly, however you take it, there is this overshadowing of the idea that perhaps having all these children was not entirely her choice. The article postulates that she wanted to graduate Juilliard, that she did not want to get married as quickly, that she did not want to have children as quickly. But her partner did, and so they did. And her partner wanted many children. Her partner didn't want her to have epidurals during birth, so she didn't. Her partner didn't want her to send the kids to school, so they homeschool. And it's this idea of whether he is driving all the choices in their relationship. And I think that is a conversation when we get into the heart of reproductive rights, is who is making the choice to have kids?
So that's exactly right. Well, I would say that, so putting the question, like, I'm not in a position to know.
No, none of us know what's going on in her marriage.
Exactly. But what I think is very interesting is that there is a certain kind of glee and satisfaction that attends the possibility of finding those interpretations. So I assume in the experience of all of our listeners right now, there are things that I do in my marriage. They don't include having eight children, but there are things that I do because maybe I would have done them slightly differently, but I do them because my partner prefers it that way. And there are many things that my partner does because it's something that I wanted. The idea that she would have achieved greater liberation as a ballerina is funny given our rising consciousness about what ballet life is considered, that we know about it now. Ballet, as some people online have pointed out, is the kind of thing, it's a career that ends at an early stage, and it could be incredibly devastating for women as well. I'm not against ballet, but what's interesting that in the responses we see this complete preference for her to have chosen the life of ballet, and the idea that even though perhaps she would have done things a little slightly differently, or maybe she wouldn't have, but that she wasn't in a position to choose freely the choices that she made, one could say there's something very condescending about that. Is it as condescending as calling childless women unhappy cat ladies? I don't know. We don't have to determine that. But I do think that we see very quick dismissal of the possibility that this was something that she has embraced. And I want to say something else. I was having a conversation recently and this came up and I thought it's such a good point. Taking a demanding career, choosing to go to travel something for a career, that involves a lot of sacrifice. Being in a relationship involves a lot of sacrifice. That is a huge investment of time as well. Just being in a romantic relationship, not being single. There's so many choices in our lives where they are big and they're consequential and they require sacrifice and changes. And we don't even raise this question about them as we do about children. And so, yes, moving back to Utah and having eight kids, required drastic choices. But if I commit myself to fitness and dedicate one of the rooms in my house to having a little gym, no one's going to ask if that's, and that means I can't use that for something else that I would have liked to as well. No one's going to think that's not a free choice. But when she says, yeah, we use the little barn as a school room as opposed to a ballet studio, something that I thought about, we assume she was coerced to do so.
I want to take a call from Chad in Grove Park. Welcome to All Sides, Chad.
Good morning. I'm loving this conversation. My wife and I, we never intended on having children. We both work professionally, and then we got one. And it was, it's not easy. It is not easy, and it's also very difficult budgeting. we're talking all of that. But to the last discussion that was being discussed, there, I agree 100% with a woman. Being in a relationship is so very hard, and being considerate is so important, and listening to the other partner. And so I appreciate everyone's work on the radio. That's all I have to say. But I agree 100%. Nothing's easy. There's no shortcuts, only long cuts.
Thanks, Chad. And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. You know, when we talk about how to possibly incentivize people to have children, and this is a conversation that happens a lot in conservative circles lately, it seems almost urgent to them that we all have more kids. I am not sure that we should be talking about people who choose not to have children. I'm not sure, for a multitude of reasons, that it's good to pressure people into having kids that they don't want. Mm-hmm. But there is this cohort of people who have one child or maybe two children and would have had another if circumstances were different. Mm-hmm. And I guess I wonder if you think that's the place governments should focus, is how do we make it easier for people to grow their families to the size that they may have actually wanted?
So I'll say this. I think the first place that I would look at if somebody's asking me about policy, and this is assuming that this is a political goal that we actually do want to advance. And I want to say that I think that the way in which conservatives today are making the case for trying to reverse birth rate trends is certainly not one that is even trying to appeal to liberals and progressives. So it's a big question of whether or not we should care about the birth rates declining. There are, as you were mentioning, economic consequences we might worry about, but those are things that can settle with time. But suppose it is something that we worry about. The place I would start is, before I would even look at people who have already made up their mind, is I would look at the kind of people we've directed our book at, which is people who are experiencing a lot of ambivalence and uncertainty. Mm. Because as I was explaining, as the question becomes more and more fraught, what we have more, I think, is not necessarily, or more of, is not people who are just so clear as to not wanting children, but it's people who do not know what shape they want their lives to take and whether or not children will be a part of it. I think that is this place where a lot of young people are in today from our findings. And what happens oftentimes is not that they raise the question, think through it, and come up with an answer, but that the question gets postponed. So as they're waiting for the permission, personal and within relationships and public, to even raise it, that decision is being made for them. So what I would want to see first is, how do we normalize an open, honest, and comfortable conversation about children, which means also about women's fertility, which also means about the shape, like you were saying, that we want family to take at an earlier stage in our lives. That would be a huge part of it. And a second thing that I'd want to emphasize is that as a consequence of the politicization that we've been talking about, of the ways in which children feature in the culture wars, among progressive and liberal men, we have an internalization of an ethic of deference. So we ask a lot of men, would you be comfortable talking to your partner about whether or not you want to have kids? And they would say, absolutely not. I would be coming off as creepy. I would be coming off as controlling, to go back to our ballerina farm conversation. But while her husband is comfortable, almost moving her to the side and saying, I'll talk to the reporter, we see men in liberal and progressive circles not even willing to raise the question. And so then we have dynamics where people are entering relationships and taking not months, but years before they're willing to even raise the question together. Do you want to have kids? Is that something that we might want to be doing together? Again, that would be fine if everybody had an infinite timeline in which to decide whether or not they want to have kids, but that is absolutely not the case. We sometimes think we have much more time, in fact, a lot of it because of kind of misplaced optimism about reproductive technology, and a lot of it because of a kind of cultural taboo on these issues. So what I would do is encourage people, and I say people, not just women, this isn't just a women's issue. I would encourage everyone to be having these conversations earlier, to welcome them, not to worry that by asking the question of children, we're already coding ourselves as conservatives and reactionary.
I want to take a call from Christy in Reynoldsburg. Welcome to All Sides, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well, thank you. I just wanted to make a couple points. I was unable to have children. In my previous life, I was married and I was forced to try, and I went through a lot of procedures and et cetera, to come to find out that I was unable. Fast forward to my new life, and I'm with someone that doesn't want to have children, and I don't find either one of us are politically less intelligent when it comes to policies, or just less intelligent in general because of that. I also have a dog, not a cat. secondly, I know a lot of women, friends that have careers and children, and the children suffer because of that, because they didn't choose to give up their career. They chose both. I also know a lot of women that have given up careers and have children. So I know both sides. And again, none of them are less intelligent than me. I don't find that at all. I think everyone should have a choice. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous.
Thank you, Christy. Yeah, I think that just sort of highlights the, you know, the why this childless cat lady comment is getting so much energy, because whether women choose to have children and the value we have in society if we don't, it's such a fraught conversation, especially when you get into whether you can have children in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's very true, and it definitely hit a very exposed nerve, and I think it has a lot to do with the way in which the role of children in our both personal lives and politically is just so much in flux right now. I would almost say that in a way, by finding this comment, for liberals and progressives, there's almost a, here he finally said it. That's what you've been thinking all along, haven't you? That's really what you think about people who make this kind of choice. For a long time, the kind of pro-life arguments have long been taken as a guise, right? A mask for what is taking to really interest conservative, which is to make sure that more women have kids, not something about the status of the fetus. So things like this. So this is really hitting upon all those buttons. I do want to say that it's very easy within the kind of climate to forget that ultimately we're talking about an incredibly personal question that of tremendous significance. So this is really a question of what shape your life, the rest of your life, will take. Another thing is that there's also a really deep philosophical, ethical question at stake, which is the value of a human future. So, you know, when we talk about kids, we often, in this kind of context, we're talking about the woman's right to choose. Sometimes we think about what I've been trying to push, which is, okay, this is the shape of your life. It's not something you should be doing you shouldn't be doing it or not doing it despite J.D. Vance. But there's also this bigger question of whether or not we think that human life has value and worth and is something that we collectively should be working to ensure persists into the future. Now, I personally think that there are more ways to do that than one. That does not mean that even if you think that a human future is a good thing, it doesn't mean that you have to have a child and contribute to that directly. But in terms of, say, policies of whether or not we think that supporting families and supporting the possibility of having children is important, we should keep that in mind, because to be against those things is ultimately to be against the things that ensure that we have a robust and flourishing human society. And if we look at the kind of things we're invested in, if it's politically, if it's ethically, if it's intellectually or artistically, these are the kind of things that presuppose a robust human future.
That was Anastasia Berg, the co-author of the book, What Are Children For? Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Coming up, we're diving into the economic impacts of having or not having children. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about why Americans are having fewer children. And I want to turn the conversation to the economic impacts of living in a country with a declining birth rate. David Blau is an Ohio State University professor emeritus with an expertise on the economics of family and children. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Thank you.
When we talk about fertility rates, I sometimes feel like we're talking about a Goldilocks number. For years, we've heard the global population was exploding. You know, could the Earth support 8 billion, 10 billion, 12 billion people? Now we're talking about declining birth rates and what will happen to our economy if fewer people are born. So, David, what's the magic number when it comes to fertility rates?
Well, there is a so-called magic number of replacement level fertility, which is measured by the total fertility rate, which is the total cumulative number of children that per woman over a lifetime. And so if that, the magic number is about 2.1, so it would take two children to replace the two parents, and then the 0.1 is to account for mortality and outmigration. But it's not a magic number in any meaningful sense that, you know, you could be above it or below it by a fairly substantial margin, and it would still not be a crisis. It becomes a crisis when you're way below it or way above it, the way we are. We're below it now.
Why is it a crisis to be way below it? Essentially, what is wrong with society getting a little smaller?
There are economic and physical consequences that are well known and understood. The size of the economy shrinks. The size of the labor force shrinks. That might reduce the level of dynamism, new firms entering the market. It puts pressure on finances for Social Security and Medicare. But there are ways to deal with it. It doesn't have to be the only way to deal with it isn't necessarily to have more children. There are other ways to respond.
I want to take a call from Amy in Marion. Welcome to All Sides, Amy.
Hi. This is an interesting twist in this conversation. I'm part of the generation that worked with zero population growth. And so now everything has flipped around, and we're being told that we should be having more children. What impact, is anyone considering what impact that's going to have on our environment for women to produce as many children as possible? I mean, Hello? That doesn't make any sense to me, especially at a time when we're dealing with global warming. And how many children do we have in this country who are living below the poverty line, not being fed, not being taken care of? I'm questioning also the conversation, previous conversation, where the woman, with the woman's husband, decided that she should not have a saddle block or drugs to deliver children. I'm wondering if he had a broken leg, if he would have that leg repaired with no drugs. What a cruel thing to impose on another person.
You know, I think that is a good question, though, that Amy raises about, you know, what would be the impact of having many, many, many more children? Because as much as we talk about the impacts of declining fertility rates, there is this challenge that comes with being part of a baby boom.
Yeah, there are several challenges. One is if you're, in a sense, unlucky enough to be part of the baby boom, then you face a lot of competition all throughout your life cycle. The schools are crowded. When you're entering the labor market, it's very crowded and there's a lot of competition. But as the listener pointed out, there are also consequences for the environment, which can be quite severe. And that's why I think it's really a mistake to imagine that the only logical response to a big decline in fertility is to try to boost fertility. There are other ways of dealing with the consequence, with the adverse consequences, and there may be some beneficial consequences in terms of less emission of greenhouse gases, less pollution, less consumption of resources.
Yeah, I read this article a while ago called It Sucks to Be 33, and it was all about the largest band of the millennial generation, who are now about 33. And the author had this great analogy, because those born around 1990 are the largest band of the millennial generation. And she described it like trying to fit your head through a sweater that's two sizes too small. And that's what it's been like in her experience to move through an economy that wasn't built for that many kids all at once. And what I find fascinating about that is that age group that's right around early 30s right now, they are choosing to have far fewer children than all the populations that have come before them. And I wonder if it's a byproduct of being part of that boom.
That's a little hard to say. The thing that we have to admit as social scientists and demographers is that we're really not very good at predicting fertility behavior. For example, the baby boom was completely unanticipated by academics and professional population forecasters. So you could certainly make the argument that there are cycles of population growth. So the baby boom was followed by a baby bust. It could be because of the difficulties that the baby boom themselves experienced with all the competition they faced from their peers. It could be for just purely economic reasons that they were not as well off as their parents and didn't feel like they could afford as many children. So it's really hard to say what causes any specific change or trend in population.
Yeah, part of that younger generation of millennials, too, they graduated into the Great Recession. So they got a job market that was not great. They carried a lot of college debt. And now as they're getting ready to buy houses and have children, interest rates have more than doubled. So in a lot of ways, they're getting hit by every negative step along the way, that all of that combined could perhaps contribute to their decision not to have kids.
Yes. And those things that you mentioned, especially entering the labor force during a recession, can have permanent impacts. You might imagine that if you're lucky, the economy will recover and you'll catch up to where you might have been if there hadn't been a recession. But there's pretty good evidence that's incomplete at best. And then the question is, okay, if I expect a permanently lower level of income than my parents had, and I saw the experience they had, am I likely to want as many children as they did or fewer?
I wonder, based on you know, someone who studies the economics of family and children, I kind of feel like all the different government interventions decide, like, I don't know that they work. That I don't know that, like, a government can incentivize people to have more kids.
A government can try, and many governments have, and the evidence seems to show that it can make bit large interventions can make a small difference on the margins. So we see countries like the Scandinavian countries and some of the other European countries that really reward additional children, that have very generous maternity leave, heavily subsidized childcare and health care. And you could, if you look really hard, you can see some possible effects. We don't really know whether it's causal, but no country has been successful in getting a substantial increase in fertility as a result of government policy. And in some sense, it's really obvious why. Over a lifetime, children are incredibly expensive, and you would need absolutely massive policies to make a difference.
That was David Blau, Ohio State University Professor Emeritus. Thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.